If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Today Healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations of Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways Healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
The will acts as a kind of microcosm of Henry VIII's life. Everything he's tried to do in his life is to ensure the succession, to ensure the future of the dynasty, to put Edward on that throne. And his will, very similarly, is dedicated to that.
That was Susanna Lipscomb discussing the will of Henry VIII in an interview with fellow historian Dan Jones. You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available from all good newsagents or via subscription. Check out our latest subscription deals at historyextra.com/subscribe. The magazine is also now available on many digital devices, including the iPad, iPhone, Kindle, Kindle Fire, Google Play, Kobo and Zinio. Look out for us in your app store or newsstand, or find out more at historyextra.com/digital. Welcome to our first podcast of February 2016. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. For this week's podcast, we're repeating a format we've tried a few times in the past, where one historian interviews another about their work. This time around, the focus is on King Henry VIII, and his will, a document that had great significance for the rest of the 16th century, and one that has been mired in historical controversy. Dr. Susanna Lipscomb, senior lecturer in early modern history at the New College of the Humanities, has written a book on the will entitled The King is Dead. And putting the questions to her was medieval historian and author Dan Jones.
For God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings. Susanna Lipscomb, that's a quotation from Shakespeare's Richard II, but it's also the quote that you take as an epigraph at the beginning of your book, The King is Dead, The Last Will and Testament of Henry VIII, which is a beautiful book, wonderfully written, impressive marriage of scholarship and narrative, and at times it reads like a detective story. And it is, as you hint, a sad story about the death of a king, King Henry VIII, arguably the most famous monarch in British history. Why did you decide to write about Henry's death?
Henry VIII's death is really interesting because, of course, it has been so contested. Like most of Henry VIII's life, one of the brilliant things about the Tudor period is that the historiography, what different historians have to say, is so binary, the really black and white positions. And Henry VIII's death in the last year of his life is used as one example of a conspiracy theory in action, so that the factions at Henry's court were operating to change the contents of Henry's will and to change the situation on his death when his son Edward would become king but would be a minor and so would need people to help rule for him. And so the whole story is a really fascinating one that tells us something about Henry's character, which I think we can't get from elsewhere. And when I started looking at it, I was really trying to approach it afresh because I'd written before about the fall of Anne Boleyn and I'd thought about faction at Henry's court, but I wanted to try and think about it anew and not take into it what I'd learnt before so much that it distorted my reading of the evidence. I wanted to say, well, you know, it may be that in the last year of Henry's life, he's so enfeebled that people can make him go where he doesn't want to go and do what he doesn't want to do, and that is what happens with the will. But as time went on, I came to decide on the basis of the evidence that that wasn't what I thought.
So Henry VIII died on the 28th of January, 1547, about 2 o'clock in the morning. Give us just a picture of what Henry was like at this final stage of his life. How old was he? What sort of shape was he in? Was he, you know, evidently he was ill, but tell us a little about him.
He was 55 years old. He was obese. We know that 7 years earlier he had a waist measurement of 54 inches. Presumably this was even bigger by the time he died.
How do we know that?
We can tell from his armour.
That the suit was at the Tower of London.
Yes, that's right. There's also one at the Met in New York. And so we know he was very big. We also know that he was disabled, essentially. He had this ulcer that had been opened up in his leg by his fall in 1536 that hadn't healed. In 1540, there's an occasion where he goes black in the face and they say they think he might die. It's something like a blood clot, essentially. And it's possible that in the end he dies from a pulmonary embolism that this is responsible for. So this is bound up, it's stinking, it's pus-filled, it's dripping, it's not very nice. And he gets moved around his palaces by this point in chairs, in sort of wheeled chairs made for the occasion, and also pulled up and downstairs by a kind of pulley system.
So you said in your book, I think, that it's the Tudor equivalent of a wheelchair and a stair lift. Physically, how does a Tudor stair lift work?
I haven't got a brilliant description of the stair lift exactly. I mean, I
sort of they had stairs and they had. I mean, I suppose this is something people, if they think about the Tudor period, would assume this wasn't part of normal life.
Well, the account that we have of this is from Elizabeth Holland, who's the Duke of Norfolk's mistress, that the king could not go up and down the stairs, but was let up and down by a device.
A device.
So I sort of imagine like one of those pulley systems with a basket, but instead you've got Henry VIII in it.
Wow. I think that's the best image of Henry VIII I've ever had, you know, for all of the sort of the fawning and the great images of him as a prince that we have from the Imperial Ambassador and whoever at the start of his reign. The idea of him like in one of those adverts at the back of the Telegraph magazine, you know, going up and down the stairs. I personally like that. Anyway, the picture I think we're getting of Henry VIII at the end of his life is he's very fat, he's very ill, he's very obese. I mean, is it possible for us to diagnose with any kind of modern medical certainty what was going on, or are we just sort of speculating about his illnesses? I mean, it is so hard to make these diagnoses over the centuries, isn't it?
It is, and the evidence that we have from his doctors isn't really good enough to do so. It helps us rule out a few things. I generally get asked whether Henry had syphilis, and it seems unlikely that he did, because syphilitic ulcers are self-healing, and because they had a treatment for syphilis which was not terribly helpful, but was to get people to inhale mercury or put it on the affected parts of their body in various forms of creams.
I think we know what we're talking about when we're talking about the affected parts of the body. I wouldn't do that.
Anyway, so it was obviously very bad for people, and there was no evidence of that. But we do, it does seem that he was, we just have these occasions where he's, you know, black in the face, or where he's having problems with the pus filled leg. And so it seems that maybe he had dropsy. There are various things that people have diagnosed. Lots of medical historians have looked at it, but...
Okay, so he's in a bad way. He's in a very bad way. And it's the end of 1546. Now, most of us, if we do plan for death, we plan for death by making a will, right? But if you or I were making our will, we might, I suppose, or I'm thinking for myself here, be leaving kind of accumulated bits and pieces of kind of tat we've... or even, you know, or money, whatever, that we've accumulated over our sort of small and insignificant lives, and we're leaving that to our loved ones, right? But, you know, £1,000 to the kids, or £1,000,000 to the cats, which, you know, some people do this. Henry VIII was a king. He wasn't like you or I, and king's wills, one assumes, are not like the wills of people you're just leaving trinkets. What was Henry VIII's will like, and what is it, or rather, what is a king's will like, and what's it all about?
A king's will, generally speaking, is about apportioning estates. This is absolutely what Henry VI had done. I'm teaching you to suck eggs here, but Edward IV, this is what their wills had been about, saying where their estates should go. And there's very little attention given in them to the subject that takes up most of Henry's will. So Henry, basically, in terms of stuff, he really leaves it all to Edward. Pretty much everything, and if you look at the inventories on Henry's death, that is a lot of stuff.
And some of this is in your book, actually, isn't it? You've extracted parts from Henry's inventory, so we are talking about the trinkets and the tat and the carpets and the tapestries and the whatnot.
Exactly, all of that, and you know, even the crown is mentioned in the inventory, and pictures and tapestries and bedspreads and everything. So. All of that is left to Edward, with the exception of some money being left to Mary and Elizabeth, £3,000 a year to live on, and a portion of money when they marry. Some money being left to, a very small amount of money being left to his wife, Catherine Parr, and such as she wants of her clothes that she already possesses. And then small amounts of money paid to members of his court, and particularly his servants and his doctors. But this is sort of a list at the end, and it isn't the real purpose of Henry VIII's will. 60% of Henry's will is dedicated to outlining plans for the succession.
Now, you mentioned Edward, Elizabeth, Mary, Catherine Parr. Can you just, in case anyone is unclear about Henry's sort of domestic situation, for want of a better term, at the end of his life, he's married to Catherine Parr. His son, Edward, is how old?
His son, Edward, was born in 1537, so he's just about 9 years old at this point in time.
And he has two daughters.
And he has two daughters who are significantly older, or at least Mary is. She's in her 20s. And Mary is his daughter by Catherine of Aragon. Elizabeth, of course, his daughter by Anne Boleyn, both of whom have been made illegitimate. And crucially, in the Acts of Succession, were first in 1536 taken out of the line of succession and made illegitimate, and then in the Act of 1544 put back in the line of succession but not legitimised, which causes problems later in the 16th century. But that's all okay, Henry thinks, because he's got his legitimate son who's going to take the throne when he dies.
Okay, so we've established that Henry VIII had a lot of stuff when he died, and it was pretty clear that the majority of that was going to be left to his son, Edward, who was going to become king after he died. Now, I sense you're hinting that Henry VIII's will is taken up with what, you know, we can concisely call succession planning. I can think of one king before Henry who had done something similar with his will, and that's Henry V, who, when he realised he was dying and leaving literally a baby, not even 1 year old, Henry VI, as king, had added codicils to his will attempting to set out what would happen to the child after his death. Henry VIII's will really takes that idea and runs with it, doesn't it?
It does, yes. So as well as laying out eight succession scenarios, then he does actually also spend time making a plan for how Edward's reign should be governed. And unlike plans for Henry VI or for Edward V and then Richard III rule, the plan is not to have a single regent, a protector, an uncle, a maternal uncle who might take power. Although, if you know your history of the 16th century, that is, of course, what happens. Henry's plan is to go back further to the examples of 1377, 1327, and to draw on a plan to have a council who will rule.
Okay, before we get stuck, I want to get stuck into the politics both of the making of the will and of Henry's conceived future for the governance and the succession. Before we do that, I wonder if you can just say a few words about the document itself. When we're talking about Henry VIII's will, what does it look like? Where is it? How long is it? Can anyone listening to this podcast, you know, see it? I know they can read it as an appendix to your book, your excellent transcription, sort of modernisation of the language. Tell us something about the document.
So the document is at the National Archives, which means that anyone can go and see it. And in fact,
the National Archives in the UK in Kew.
In Kew, yes, that's right. And in fact, you can actually also download it.
It's been digitised.
It's been digitised. They've taken photographs of it. And it's a beautiful thing. It's 28 folios. It's parchment. It's written in this beautiful, gorgeous secretary hand by Sir William Paget. And it has Henry's signature, or at least we'll come to that, at the beginning and end, and 10 witnesses also sign it.
You say 28 folios. That's long.
Yes, it is long.
Document.
It is a long document. It's about 5,000-6,000 words.
It's longer than Magna Carta, for example. In terms of, yeah, if we're thinking about big historical documents, this is a seriously substantial piece of seriously substantial document.
That's right, and it has very important provisions to make. At the beginning, it sets out sort of with a spiritual preface, saying, you know, Henry's beliefs, plans for his funeral, money to be left to be given to the poor and to people to pray for his soul. So it sets out with very conventional things, plans for his tomb, which incidentally none of his children quite got round to finishing. He was sort of borrowing what remained of Wolsey's plans for his tomb, but his children didn't put the money into it.
It's interesting, sorry, just as a sidebar there, you mentioned, there is Henry VIII, you would expect for this sort of outsize king to have an outsize tomb, but actually he's just sort of buried under a kind of slab in Windsor, isn't he?
He is, a black slab with Jane Seymour and, and he's not, they're not the only two in there, and, people walk up and down across it all the time because it's in the aisle at St George's Chapel. No, but he planned a huge monument that was going to really glorify him, that he would be on horseback and, you know, it would all be tremendously impressive. And it didn't come about because his children didn't finance it.
Which is strange because normally, previously kings would build their own tombs. And it's strange that apart from Henry VII, none of the Tudor monarchs built their own tomb, did they? Elizabeth and Mary are both in that one made by James VI. Anyway,
that's right.
We're getting off the topic here. I wonder if you can just set the scene, because obviously this is a very political document. We've established it's a very long document. We have a picture of Henry ill at the end of his reign. Give us a little background, if you would, about the big issues of the reign at this time. What is animating people and what are the controversies of Henry's reign in the mid-1540s?
Well, the most controversial issue of Henry's reign in total is religion.
Yeah.
So Henry has broken from the Church of Rome by 1534, it's quite contested amongst historians exactly what happens after that point, but it's certainly there are moves towards further reform. There's the dissolution of the monasteries. There are acts against pilgrimages and shrines. There's the Bible in English. But it doesn't go as far as the Reformation on the continent under Luther, for example. So some people are wanting further reform, and there are others who wanted to go further back into conservative, more Catholic practices. That is an issue, and there are people dying for that. So there are sacramentarians, people who don't believe that the bread and wine becomes Christ's body and blood, and who are willing to argue that to the death, to the point of being burnt for heresy in Henry VIII's England. Matters of faith are really hot topics at the time and determining action. And also, of course, there's war with France, sort of perennial theme. So there's been war in France back in the 1540s. By the time Henry dies, they have made peace in this elaborate peace celebration in summer of 1546. But there's always the question of what will happen next if there is a young boy on the throne. And so those are the sort of key things, I suppose, that are going on at the time, and whether one son is going to be enough for the succession.
Mm. Okay, so then now let's talk about this murky area of how exactly the will was drawn up. Had Henry made a will before the point when he became seriously ill and it seemed that he was going to die?
Yes, he had. We know because in December 1546, he asked to see his will and wants to make changes to it. And there's some evidence to suggest that it might be actually the third iteration by that point, rather than just the second.
But do we have those?
Not as far as I know. No, so that they don't seem to survive. There was some talk about there being two in December 1546. Some historians have argued that the one at the Inner Temple Library is actually another version, but because it says the 13th of December, but it's almost certainly just a scribe's mistake, and it's the same as a copy of the 30th of December. So we only have the one.
Okay, so it's the end of the year, 1546. Henry's very ill. He calls to see the previous will that he has made. He's going to update his will. Tell us what happens.
So he calls to see it, and he wants to make changes, he says. He wants to put out some people who were previously in it. And what by that he means he wants to change the list of people who will be on the council, the regency council, when Edward comes to the throne, i.e. the people who have de facto power to rule. Mm-hmm. And one of the names that we know he takes out is Stephen Gardiner, Bishop of Winchester.
A conservative, right?
Who's a conservative in faith. The other person he must have taken out is Thomas Howard, Duke of Norfolk. Another conservative, because Norfolk and his son Surrey have already earlier in December been arrested for treason. There's also some stick about putting somebody in who is probably Thomas Seymour. But the key thing is that Gardiner and Norfolk fall from the list. And with Gardiner, what we're told is that the king... I mean, we have various different eyewitness accounts of this. Those are recorded in the 1550s. And the king clearly says something like, Gardiner is too willful to be around his son, that you cannot control him. He says that he could rule over him, but you shall never do so. So he's saying to his other courtiers that Gardiner, you know, is bolshy. He gets his way. He wants certain things, and therefore he is a dangerous person to put in the presence of a young, easily influenced boy.
And so who does Henry, in his last will and testament, say that he does want around his son Edward, 9 years old, at some point about to become? I mean, you don't have to give me the full list, but give me an idea of the people that Henry says he wants around young Edward.
So he draws up a list of 16 councillors. So they are Henry's most senior and trusted men. They are those who have served him well by that point.
And presumably, given that Edward is from the Seymour family, we're going to have people who are connected to his mother's side. So we know that Thomas Seymour is going to be important in the next reign. Edward Seymour. Yes, Thomas Seymour. But Thomas Seymour married Catherine.
He did go on to marry Catherine Parr. So we've got people like Thomas Cranmer, who Archbishop of Canterbury, of course, who's been so important in pressing forward reform. We've got sort of long-time supporters of Henry, long-time servants like John Lord Russell or William Powlett. We've got John Dudley, Viscount Lisle, and we've got, as you say, Edward Seymour, who is Henry's brother-in-law and uncle to the young boy who will become king.
Now, without wanting to... I know this is a sort of live issue in terms of debate about Henry's will, so without wanting to cast forward too much, can we characterise, though, that group of people as religious evangelicals, reformers, I don't want to use the word Protestant, but that kind of religious set, is Henry imagining that his son, who, as historians we know, will turn out to be quite a reform-minded, evangelical-minded, Protestant-minded even king, is that something that Henry VIII is envisaging in late 1546?
Many of the people I've named are people who are evangelical, i.e. proto-Protestant in their belief. But there are also others like Cuthbert Tunstall, the Bishop of Durham, or Thomas Wriothesley, the Lord Chancellor, who are definitely not. They're definitely conservative in faith. And I don't think that's... So this is contested. Other historians disagree with me. I don't think that this is what is determining Henry's plans. I certainly don't think that he's casting forward to create an evangelical group who will rule over his son, because if we look at the rest of the will, it's very conservative. He asks the Virgin Mary, in fact, he demands the Virgin Mary to pray for his soul. You know,
Only Henry VIII tell the Virgin Mary what to do.
And, you know, in fact, that he leaves money for prayers for his soul is a very Catholic doctrine. You know, he believes that he may be in purgatory. So there's no evidence that he would be making provision for a sort of swing to Protestantism after his death. I just don't think that he imagines what will happen, what does happen after his death.
So could we characterise it by saying that he's just putting a bunch of competent people whom he trusts around his son?
He trusts them utterly. He describes them as his right, entirely beloved, trusted servants, and he charges them, you know, as they will answer at the day of judgment, to do everything he asks them to do in his will.
Right.
So he, as it turns out, his trust is misplaced, but he does trust them.
Now, I sense we're going to wander into the realm of historical controversy when I ask you the next question, but the way you're describing the situation in December 1546, when Henry's very ill and he's making his will, he sounds like a very active player. Do you think he was directing events? He's as ill as you've described. Could he possibly be directing events? And if so, why? If not, tell us why not.
It is controversial. He is ill often during the last year of his life, but every time he rallies, and he does seem to be involved in political affairs up to a few days before he dies, meeting ambassadors, making decisions about war. So I think that he absolutely is competent at this last stage and directing events. The counter-argument is that this decision to move Gardiner and Norfolk from the will is one that has been a coup by people like Edward Seymour, Earl of Hertford, and by John Dudley, Viscount Lisle, who are evangelicals, to influence the position after Henry's death. That has been the orthodoxy up until now, but by contrast, I'm saying I don't think that Henry is enfeebled to the point of doing it, because the evidence seems to me to suggest that Henry is fully in charge of events.
OK, now, to borrow a phrase from Stephen Fry, I'm going to play devil's avocado and say, to return briefly to the text of the will, a lot of people would argue, if they were going to argue for non-competence, let's say, by which I mean if they're going to argue that Henry was by now defunct as a king, too ill, ready to have a role in events, they would say the only thing you have to look at is the way that this will has been signed, quote unquote, because the way that the will is signed, as you've said, at the beginning, at the end, is not the way that you or I, maybe you, but certainly not I, would sign a document today, is it? Tell us about the way that Henry's will is signed.
It's signed by dry stamp, which is a device that's been made to free Henry from the tedium of signing all these state documents all the time. So it creates an impression of his signature, and then three designated clerks ink in very carefully in the impression to create Henry's signature. But dodgy as that may sound, and of course it allows utter possibilities for abuse because, by definition, Henry doesn't have to be present for it to be applied. Actually, it has been used since September 1545. So something like 1,600 state documents have had this applied to it, none of the rest of which are in contestation as being legitimate, genuine legal documents from Henry's reign. But it becomes interesting in the case of the will because it has been suggested by some historians that the will was tampered with after signature, or that it wasn't signed at the time, signed in inverted commas at the time that it said that it was signed, which is the 30th of December, 1546. What's interesting about it is that these clerks who do this have to be regularly pardoned for treason, for the treason of counterfeiting the king's signature. So there's a system in place. And the other backup is that all of these documents that are signed by a dry stamp have to be entered into a schedule of documents, a list of documents, so that it's clear, and then Henry endorses that, so it's clear what has had that treatment.
So just to recap, Henry's will, like 1600 other documents from the sort of last 2 years of his reign, it's physically like an ink stamp, except with no ink. It makes an impression on paper, and then some poor guys with a quill have to colour it. He's incredibly lazy. What's wrong with the man?
Well, he's ill, as we've discussed. So
I'm ill. I've got a cold, as listeners can hear, but I signed a cheque this morning for my daughter's school. I didn't use a dry stamp.
That's why you won't be leaving £1 million to the cats.
That's true.
Yes, but, you know, Henry has a lot of paperwork to do, and busy as your life might be, Dan, I think that the King of England probably had a little bit more to attend to. And so in the light of slightly inflated illness over a cold, obviously, that, you know, and maybe just boredom. I mean, you know, the guy's been doing this for 30-odd years, and he's tired of doing it, and he trusts his servants. And anyway, for whatever reason, he creates this stamp.
Okay, so he uses the dry stamp, and this is how the will has been authenticated. It's been dry stamped. But you believe that's perfectly fine and legitimate. Now, there's one other thing that people would argue, which is to say that, hang on a second, you said the will was dry stamped, authenticated on the 30th of December, 1546.
That's right.
And then you said that the will is also entered into a sort of ledger of documents that have been authenticated with the dry stamp. But that doesn't happen on the 30th of December 1546, does it? It happens in January 1547. A suspiciously long gap, some would argue.
Yes, some would. So some people argue from the fact that it's in the January 1547 schedule, that indicates that it was signed later.
But it's fishy. People say that's fishy. Why does that happen?
So I think there's a problem with this argument, though, because it certainly is the penultimate item in the schedule of January 1547, which is when Henry dies, so the penultimate item on these schedules at all. And it's in this big flourishing letter. If that makes sense. There's a big flourish at the start of it. It says, Your Majesty, so-and-so, and describes it. A separate document from the will, yes. It's a list of documents that's signed by dry stamp. So it's not that somebody is quietly trying to put it into the schedule so that it can just pass by. It's there in very big letters declaring that His Majesty's will. So there is a question of what did they make just sort of forget to put it in the December one? That seems unlikely for such an important constitutional document. And what it seems to me is that actually, probably because Henry VIII was present when the dry stamp was applied, it seemed unnecessary to put it in another document that he then endorses, saying, yes, you did apply the dry stamp to this document. But that in January 1547, when it looks like the king is on his last legs, that he is going to die, they suddenly become terrified that the legality of the will be undermined by it not also being on the schedule of documents. And therefore they put it in big letters so everyone can see it absolutely is legal, the will is as it's supposed to be. If they'd been trying to attempt some sort of fishy business with this, then clearly it would have been silently entered at some point in relatively small writing not to be noticed or something like that. If you had tampered with the will, why would you advertise the fact so in such a big way at the end of the will? It doesn't make sense.
Okay,
to me.
Well, you've convinced me, but I'm very easily swayed. However, you convinced me, and readers can delve into your book, The King is Dead, The Last Will and Testament of Henry VIII, to find out a little more. Now, we've established already that Henry VIII, his will, we think, was legitimate. He'd set up the personnel of the council. He wanted to be around his son, Edward VI, when his young son, 9, 10 years old, succeeded to the crown after him. You mentioned earlier that the will also deals with the business of succession past Edward, contingency, alternative scenarios. What if Edward VI you know, this being the 16th century, doesn't make it into adulthood. How many scenarios does the will imagine?
There are eight succession scenarios. So, first of all, you've got Edward, obviously, and, you know, if he lives long and prospers, then he can, and then his heirs. Failing that, if he dies, then it goes to any heirs by Catherine Parr, you know, Henry's heirs by Catherine Parr. Scenario three is any heirs by any future wife.
It's very optimistic, actually, isn't it? It really is.
Scenario four is Mary and her heirs, if she marries according to the advice of this Privy Council that Henry is also stating.
OK, so that's quite significant, isn't it? Because, again, without wishing to roll too far forward, we have Edward, of real people who actually exist at this point, the succession is imagined as being Edward, then Mary, of Henry's living children.
That's right.
Even though
Mary is still illegitimate, right, technically, under law, from 1536 onwards, she's Lady Mary, she's not Princess Mary. Both the marriage to Catherine of Aragon and the marriage to Anne Boleyn were declared as null and void, and so she is stated to be illegitimate, which is one of the arguments that Edward will use against making Mary his heir.
But then, okay, so who's next after Mary?
Elizabeth.
Who is also illegitimate.
Also illegitimate. So then next, after that...
So is that way round, sorry to harangue you on this, is that order of succession purely a matter of age?
Yes.
Yeah. Because Mary's older than Elizabeth.
Yeah, that's right.
All right.
And because they're both illegitimate, so one doesn't trump the other. And then after that, we have the heirs of Henry VIII's niece, Lady Frances. So this is interesting because it means that he skipped over... Henry has two sisters, Margaret and Mary. Margaret has married into the Scottish line of kings, and her descendants will eventually be James VI, who will take the throne after Elizabeth, as James I. But Henry doesn't acknowledge that line at all because they're Scottish-born. He is only interested in the descendants from his sister Mary, his younger sister. And he doesn't name...
He would marry Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk.
That's right, yep. And her daughter, Frances, it's her heirs that he names in the will. He doesn't name Frances herself, which is quite interesting. She is skipped over. I don't know why. I think it seems to be probably that it's notable that her husband is not recommended in the council, doesn't really have any power. Maybe he was a buffoon. Maybe Frances has, you know, it's not thought that she is a capable person of ruling because of the influence of her husband. But her daughters, who are the Grey sisters, most famously, of course, Lady Jane Grey, are named. And then if that fails, the next scenario Henry imagines is the heirs of Lady Eleanor, who's Frances's sister. And then the last thing he says is, you know, sort of giving up to the next rightful heirs.
You know, you guys figure this out. I mean, I've given you enough options.
Yeah.
On the one hand, that seems remarkably thorough. On the other hand, it does strike me as being the most extraordinarily kind of controlling and egomaniacal way of thinking, which is not only to say, my kids, give it them in order, boy first, then girl after that, work it out. But this desire to control the politics, the future, the, in some senses, the constitution of England. I mean, this succession planning is stretching potentially decades into the future. What's wrong with him?
I think that's absolutely characteristic of Henry, though, that he wants to rule from the grave. You know, he wants to continue to have influence over the rest of the centuries. History, over the dynasty, and because he's been so powerful in his lifetime, he utterly assumes that this is possible. And what is fascinating is that you go from a position where he is somebody who's so powerful, so ruthless, his word is law, practically, to the point where he dies and suddenly everything changes, all bets are off. But he is absolutely trying to control it. And what's then very interesting is, of course, and I am looking forward here, but when Edward dies, he tries to do the same thing. He tries to play the same game as his father had done and determine who will be his successor. Unfortunately, it doesn't quite go through Parliament in time, but he does write his device for the succession, naming his heir, and he's trying to act like Henry does in his will.
Yeah, it's considerably younger. I mean, this speaks to... I've bored you with this before, but I think Henry VIII is the most childish man in British history. Anyway, this is the...
Well, hold on a second. Wait.
This is the psychology of a child. This is the psychology of a spoiled child who wants to be in charge of absolutely everything all the time, and he's completely immature.
It's the psychology of a ruler who doesn't feel that the people around him are sufficiently... capable of choosing the future, of determining the future. You don't even think that, do you? You just said it just to wind me up.
Why would I try and wind you up? Live on the BBC. Right. Okay, so I think, have we covered everything that's in Henry VIII's will? We've covered the composition of Edward's council, and we've covered Henry's plan for the succession, and we know that Henry also made some sort of quasi-Catholic provision for his soul.
Yeah, I guess there are two crucial things to say. One is that... The reason the will is so important is that Henry has had it passed in an Act of Parliament saying that he could determine his succession by his last will or by letters patent, which no monarch before has tried to do. And the second thing is that he says in it that his chief labour and study in this world has been to put him, meaning Edward, in the crown imperial in the realm. So, which I think means that the will acts as a kind of microcosm of Henry VIII's life. Everything he's tried to do in his life is to ensure the succession, to ensure the future of the dynasty, to put Edward on that throne. And his will, very similarly, is dedicated to that.
Now, earlier on, I mentioned Henry V, and I mentioned Henry V because, like Henry VIII, he made a will, he laid out a plan for what should happen regarding the governance of his child, son, after he died. In the case of Henry V, everyone basically ignored it. I mean, what Henry V set up was ignored, and they got on with it the way they saw fit. What happened in the case of Henry VIII? He died on the 28th of January 1547, 2 o'clock in the morning. Play the story forward from there.
So his death is kept a secret for several days. Parliament continues to sit, whereas Parliament should normally immediately dissolve on the death of a king. Food continues to be brought to his chambers with trumpeters playing. And meanwhile, behind the scenes, Hertford, Edward Seymour, and Lord and with Paget's help, who's the king's chief secretary who'd drawn up the will, are going to make sure they have Edward, the person of Edward. They're going to find the boy. And they're keeping the information about Henry's death close to their chests so that they have Edward before they announce Henry is dead and this is the provision he made in his will. And we know they're preoccupied by the matter of the will because in the letters that passed between Paget and Hertford at this time, Hertford has forgotten to leave the key with Paget to the box that the will is in. So there's this sort of middle of the night letters, they're dated at 2 a.m, 4 a.m, to send the key back so I can get the will, because this is the thing that gives them power, that puts them on the council, that means that they can establish themselves. But what's really interesting is that very quickly after Henry's death, so whilst Henry has made provision for a council that will rule together, the council get together and take advantage of one other clause in his will, which has said that the council can do whatever they think is necessary and meet for the security and peace of the realm. And they decide that what is necessary is to go against the wishes of the will and to nominate, although they protest that they don't say they're doing that, they say they're going along with the will, and they nominate one person who will be the head of the council, the Lord Protector, who is Edward Seymour, Earl of Hertford. So within days, Henry's wishes for this council ruling as a body of equals have been overturned.
Why do you think that happened? And by the way, when we say Edward Seymour, Earl of Hertford, we're talking about Edward VI's maternal uncle.
We are, who also becomes
Seymour's brother.
Jane Seymour's brother, who very soon becomes Duke of Somerset, because before Henry died, he'd drawn up a list of titles that he wanted to be bestowed on members of the nobility, because, frankly, so many of them being killed off in his reign, there aren't that many of them around. And Henry has, you know, drawn this up with Paget, and there's another clause in his will that says any gifts that he hasn't fulfilled or should be fulfilled by the council. And happily enough, the ones that give them titles and money are the ones that get enacted quickly.
So, but why do we think the council then, in complete defiance of Henry's will, say, we're not going to rule as council, we're going to have effectively a protector who will become, Edward will protect Somerset. Why?
It's a good question. I mean, I think that they must genuinely think that this is the way to rule.
It's a difficult one because Hertford is a haughty, not very attractive character, but he must have had a charisma, and his sort of the rightness of his status. You know, he is the king's most senior male relative at this time. He has had great success on the battlefield. You know, he's not someone you can easily cross. He looks like the right sort of person, even if he's not terribly nice. Must have been the reason why they, you know, essentially give him power.
Do you think there's a, I mean, it's possible, isn't it, that that for all the kind of grand theorising on Henry's part about how he wants government ideally to be constituted, you are faced in a monarchical system with the basic fact that this is a system set up to be governed over by one person, isn't it? I mean, and no matter how much everyone would like it to be workable by committee, it very rarely is. And it would seem sensible, pragmatic politics to do things the way they did things, wouldn't it?
I mean, I think it's an interesting point because one of the things that's been debated about the will is the extent to which asking for a council was an unusual clause. Actually, there has been research, some of my colleagues at the New College of Humanities have looked at kind of medieval wills or at Renaissance literature at the time, which is very much actually arguing in favour of council rule. The latest sort of humanist statements on these sort of things are arguing that councils are the best way to rule. But maybe there is still this tension between these two things, that actually it is hard if you've had, if you've grown up your lifetime under Henry VIII, to imagine a system without one man at the head of the realm. It is probably very difficult that they can only think of power of being vested in one monarch who has that personal power rather than it being something that is diffuse.
And do you think that any of it is related to Somerset, let's call him's personal relationship with the young king? Because, I mean, if I just to sort of cast a broad perspective going back to, you know, the 14th century, Edward VI becomes king at a very, very difficult age, probably the most difficult age, because if you take the example of Henry VI, baby, 9 months old, it's actually, in the 1420s, they found it relatively straightforward to govern with a tiny baby as king, because that king has no will and cannot provide any equity in the sense of you know, independent judgment within a system. And so actually that's one of the only situations in which conciliar government actually works. What do you have in the case of Edward VI, or let's say Richard II, when he became king at 10 years old, is a king who is half-formed and is at the most dangerous age, where he has part of his will in the sense that he can think semi-independently, but is not obviously not experienced. So that's a long way of asking the question, but do you think Somerset's advancement to that position was as a result of his familial bond with the new king?
I'm sure that is part of it. And one thing that's very interesting is that Catherine Parr, Henry's wife, when he dies, had previously had positions of importance in Henry's government, had been regent, just as Catherine of Aragon, her namesake, had been when Henry went to war in the 1540s, but has no position at all in the rule of her son after Henry's death, as if Somerset is capitalising on his familial connection and not allowing that to be influenced by someone like a mother who might direct Edward towards other things. And it's true about his age. It is a very tender and vulnerable age, he does need to be kind of cosseted and made to do things. By the end of his reign, 6 years later, when he's in his teens, he clearly does have wishes about certain things. He is particularly, as teenagers often are, filled with a kind of piebald mentality about religion. He has a real sense of what is right and what is wrong. He probably doesn't have that at 9 years old, but he does need to be controlled. So I think there is something in making the most of the family connection and keeping him close that's important.
How long did Henry VIII's will shape English politics? Because we've just established that actually one of the first things that was done after Henry died was they kicked one of the most important points out of the window. How long did the... Was the rest of it just totally ignored? How long did it continue to shape English politics?
Well, it comes back. It actually goes on to shape the succession for the rest of the 16th century. As it so happens, it plays out as Henry had dictated. But even Somerset's downfall, they appeal to the will. So a couple of years later, in 1549, when Somerset has been throwing himself his weight around too much, really, and not acting on the advice of the other councillors, the other councillors look to the will to say, no, hold on a second, this is supposed to be council rule. And then, of course, whilst Edward, using the example of the rule, tries to nominate Lady Jane Grey, when Mary stages the coup, as it were, takes back the throne from Lady Jane Grey, she mentions the will and says, I am in line to the throne because of my father's will. Elizabeth also mentions Henry's will early on in her reign. So there's a constant referral back to the will as being the sort of source of their legitimacy, even though they are illegitimate. And then, actually, interestingly, Mary, Queen of Scots, and her government try to use the fact that the will was signed by dry stamp to argue that it's illegitimate and therefore Mary, Queen of Scots, should have the throne of England. So the will is this constant point of reference throughout the 16th century, and as it so happens, everything he plans for is carried through. By the time of Elizabeth's death, of course, it's all changed, and who is available to take the throne is a very different scenario, and Henry couldn't have foreseen quite that far ahead. But his plans have actually, by accident, as it turns out, been carried through.
Which I suppose is just as he would have wanted it.
Exactly so. Although he'd been very disappointed in Elizabeth for not marrying and producing heirs, I think.
Well, Susanna Lipscombe, The King is Dead, The Last Will and Testament of Henry VIII, published by Head of Zeus, and as well as being sort of wonderful, as I say, a narrative, a detective story, a fantastic piece of scholarship with, I think, the first transcription of the will for some time.
The last one was in the 18th century, so yeah.
Okay, so this is actually a serious piece of historical work, which you all need on your bookshelves. As usual, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you for your praise. It's very kind.
Thank you very much.
That was Susanna Lipscombe in conversation with Dan Jones. Susanna's book, The King is Dead, is out now in the UK and the US, published by Head of Zeus. And Susanna will also be delivering a free talk about Henry's will as part of the New College of the Humanities Spring Lecture Series. It's taking place at Senate House, London, on the 22nd of February. For more information and tickets, visit nchlondon.ac.uk and follow the link in the news tab. Dan Jones's most recent book is Realm Divided, A Year in the Life of Plantagenet England, which is available now. And you can hear him talking about that book on our podcast episode that was released on the 15th of October last year and is still available to download.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match. With Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? you need Indeed.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
If you went on a road trip and you didn't stop for a Big Mac or drop a crispy fry between the car seats or use your McDonald's bag as a placemat, then that wasn't a road trip. It was just a really long drive. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's.
Now it's time for the latest history news with our digital editor, Emma Mason.
Henry VIII's erratic behaviour in the later years of his life was caused by brain damage resulting from a jousting injury, new work suggests. According to a team of US researchers, the infamous Tudor monarch may have suffered repeated traumatic brain injuries similar to those experienced by some American football players, the Daily Mail reports. This, researchers claim, would explain Henry's memory problems, explosive anger, headaches, insomnia, inability to control impulses, and even impotence. Henry VIII is best remembered for executing two of his six wives and for breaking away from the Catholic Church in what became known as the Reformation. Dr. Salardini, behavioural neurologist and co-director of the Yale Memory Clinic, said, "It is intriguing to think that modern European history may have changed forever because of a blow to the head." Look out for our interview with Dr. Salardini, plus Tudor historian Tracy Borman's counter-argument at historyextra.com. In other news, a new study carried out on prehistoric bones discovered at Stonehenge in 2008 has found that around half belonged to women. Researchers who examined the remains of some 200 adults said the findings showed a, quote, surprising degree of gender equality. The findings, which are reported in the magazine British Archaeology, contradict artistic portrayals of prehistoric man as in charge of the site, with, quote, barely a woman in sight. The findings are also important because burial at Stonehenge was likely to have been reserved for selected people of higher status. Meanwhile, a shortlist has been announced of historical figures who could appear on a new £10 note issued in Scotland. The shortlist includes science writer Mary Somerville, engineer Thomas Telford, and physicist James Clerk Maxwell, who all carried out pioneering work during the 19th century. More than 400 people nominated a Scottish figure that they felt had made a significant contribution in the fields of science and innovation. And earlier this week, the Royal Bank of Scotland announced the three-strong shortlist. The final decision will be made after a public vote ends. It is running until Sunday the 7th of February on the bank's Facebook page.
Before we go, I'd like to remind you that the February issue of BBC History magazine is currently on sale. In this month's edition, we have articles on Henry IV, the Battle of Verdun, Benjamin Franklin, Dad's Army, and a whole lot more. You can get hold of our February edition in all good newsagents and our many digital formats. Well, that's pretty much it for this week, but do listen in next time when we're going to be paying a visit to Benjamin Franklin's London home to find out about the American founding father's sojourn in Britain. And if you can't wait that long for more history audio content, then you might like to try our History of Britain special podcast, which can be downloaded for free from our website. Visit historyextra.com/Britain podcast to listen to that. Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future episodes. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you will find history quizzes, galleries, articles, and more. Plus, it's where you can download every single previous episode of this podcast.